Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You want the American economy in one sentence? We've got the American economy in one sentence from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday, the 15th of June. It is good to have you along as always, everybody. The sentence in question reads in part like this. Quote, information received since the Federal Open Market Committee met in April indicates that the pace of improvement in the labor market has slowed, end of quote. Credit on that one goes, of course, to the Federal Reserve, which wrapped up its two-day meeting on interest rates today. The economy is fine, Chair Janet Yellen said. They're just a hair worried about jobs and the global situation. Translation, Brexit. No rate hike, of course. Tune in again on July the 27th for another installment of What is Janet Yellen Thinking? One of the things Dr. Yellen pointed out today is that consumers are generally spending more, and that is a generally positive sign. The flip side of that coin, however, comes from a company called Synchrony Financial, the biggest issuer of retail store credit cards in this country. It says more consumers are missing payments on those cards, a data point that comes as the percentage of late car loan payments also ticks up as well. No, the numbers aren't huge, but canary in the coal mine and all that. Ashley Milne-Tite is on it.
The thing about store credit cards is they're easy to come by. A few words from the clerk at the checkout and you can apply. Matt Schultz with creditcards.com says many people who sign up can't afford to.
Retail credit cards have substantially higher interest rates than the average general purpose credit card.
He says that's why these particular cards are leading the move into delinquencies. Brian Riley is Principal Executive Advisor for Information Services Company CEB. He says it's too soon for alarm bells.
Generally speaking, the economy is sound, but we have things like gasoline now up about 10, at least in my market, it's up 10% than where it was in the beginning of the year. And we're entering summer months. So, you know, there are signs that there is deterioration on the consumer side.
Joel Bynes of consultancy Alex Partners says the economic recovery has left plenty of consumers behind. And lately, banks have gone back to their pre-recession ways, lending to people who shouldn't be borrowing, whether it's regular credit or car loans, because they make money off them.
The model of loosen credit standards to chase yield and lend deeper to a segment of consumers, it just doesn't end well. I mean, it never ends well.
He says we're not looking at another situation as dramatic as the housing crisis. But he says banks are gambling on economically strapped consumers, and some investors are going to be left holding the bag. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
I would humbly suggest that when one Janet Yellen, arguably the world's most powerful economist, says on the record that she is worried about global uncertainty, that the smart money says you ought to pay attention. The real money is moving on the order of hundreds of billions of dollars. The phrase you're looking for in times like this is safe havens, gold and bonds and cash. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
Just what are people uncertain about? Well, there's the outcome of the U.S. presidential election, the possibility of Britain's exit from the EU, worries over the Chinese economy.
We have wars and threats of wars in the Middle East, disruptions in the energy market. We have things going on in South America.
James Angel teaches finance at Georgetown University.
Look around the world. There is no shortage of things to worry about.
So where are people moving their money? Guy Labat of Janney Montgomery Scott says a lot of it's going to bonds.
One exchange-traded fund which represents an investment in all of the bond markets, it's called the Aggregate Bond Market ETF, has seen inflows in the neighborhood of about $6 billion this year.
Bonds, of course, tend to do well when the economy deteriorates, but it's not all doom and gloom, says Scott Wrent, an equity strategist at Wells Fargo. He's not scared, but he's glad some people are.
The more people that are fearful, that are taking money out of the market keeps going higher, you know, that's a good thing in my book.
Wren says people have been pulling out as the S&P 500 nears a record high. He thinks we'll hit that high.
There may be one out in the seventh inning, but basically, you know, there's some baseball left to be played, and I think you're going to see some good, not great, returns over the next 2, maybe 3 years in the stock market.
And that can mean decent gains for those who don't mind a little uncertainty. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
23rd of June, by the way, is that Brexit vote. Traders held up pretty well throughout the day and Janet Yellen's press conference. Then, for some reason, they got spooked at the bell. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We were talking the other day about Valeant Pharmaceuticals, a big hedge fund favorite until it wasn't. Valeant shares are down 90% from their high, 90%, after the company's strategy of buying up drugs and then jacking up prices fell apart. But the fact is that the shareholder value model has transformed the pharmaceutical industry's model. Dan Bobkoff, who is with Business Insider, our partner in our shareholder value series, The Price of Profits, talked with a couple of pharma CEOs. Here's Dan.
This is how big pharma works today. Instead of relying on their own expensive laboratories, they buy drugs, or their makers, and focus on getting them through the FDA and onto your TV screens. Then, raise prices every year, move overseas for tax advantages, and reward shareholders by buying back billions worth of shares. It wasn't always like that, says Joel Hay, a professor of pharmaceutical economics at the University of Southern California.
George Merck summed it up. The mission of Merck, and I think other pharmaceutical companies at the time, was to take care of patients and profits would follow.
And the profits will follow. Yeah, it was a big part of our culture.
Scott Lucas worked in sales at Merck & Company for more than 30 years, starting in the late 70s. Lucas and other workers describe an era of the highest ethical and moral standards. In the second half of the 20th century, Merck really was a company where shareholder value was the result, not a prime motivation. Merck ran huge productive research labs full of top-notch scientists. In charge of those labs was Roy Vagelos, who went from chief scientist to become CEO in 1984.
I'll tell you, my interest was never making money.
This is Roy Vagelos.
Even as CEO, especially as CEO.
By today's standards of management, it sounds like Vagelos did everything wrong on drug prices.
I can't understand why you would increase it beyond the consumer price index or in some measure of inflation.
When you brought this idea to the marketing folks, what did they tell you?
They said we're leaving money on the table, of course. And I said, fine, that's what we'll do.
He bailed out of business school after just a week, which is maybe why he didn't think much about Wall Street.
I never worried about stockholders, ever. It never crossed my mind. I even refused to meet with stock analysts.
At one point, he made a last-minute decision to donate a massive quantity of a drug that cured river blindness in patients in Africa. It cost the company a lot of money.
One of the people on the next board meeting said, you know, you never called us. I said, you know, it was going so fast, it never crossed my mind, I forgot about it.
You can be cynical about this if you want. You could argue holding down drug prices helped stave off regulations, and there were a lot of PR benefits to that donation in Africa. But by not focusing on maximizing shareholder value, Merck did really well. During his era, it came out with a lot of new drugs, which led Merck's stock price to increase an average of 22% a year. In the years since, it was just 5% a year. But these days, it's just about impossible to run a company the way Vagelos ran Merck.
You have to provide a little bit of something for everybody.
Brent Saunders is the CEO of Allergan. You might know it as the maker of Botox. His company is highly respected by Wall Street and his competitors. But Saunders can't ignore investors.
So you need to have good short-term performance. You have to have sound mid-term strategy and performance. And ultimately, because of the product cycle and the way we innovate over the long term, really have conviction around your long-term strategy.
Here are some of the ways Allergan is a model of a modern pharmaceutical company, as I described a minute ago. Research, prices, taxes. It more often acquires drugs or companies rather than go through the risky process of discovering and developing drugs from scratch. A good portion of its R&D time is spent finding new uses for existing drugs, like
Botox Cosmetic. Stand up to chronic migraine with Botox. Botox treats symptoms of leaking, going too often, and the
And that's just the beginning. Owner Tulum is a researcher at UMass Lowell.
their success heavily based on a drug that seems to be just like the market opportunities are almost endless. It's like milk in a cup.
Here's Saunders.
Well, yeah, I do think Botox is still a pipeline and a product is what I like to call it.
And Saunders can't ignore his share price, especially now that he has one of the most famous activist investors taking a big stake in Allergan, Carl Icahn.
Yeah, look, I view Carl as just one of many important shareholders.
Icahn is leaving Saunders alone for now, but that could change. He has a history of pressuring companies to make moves and then getting out of the stock. Next, to save on taxes, Allergan is technically an Irish company, even though Saunders mostly works in New Jersey. It caused a little tension between Saunders and his father.
I was arguing that taxes aren't a question of patriotism. I said he had moved to Florida because it has zero state income tax and zero estate tax. And I said, look, you did a personal inversion.
Saunders says being based in Ireland allows Allergan to use the savings to invest more in the U.S. Okay, one more, prices. Allergan says it raises prices roughly 8% a year, far greater than inflation, but also nothing like a Valiant. Talking to Saunders, he sometimes sounds a bit like Dr. Vagelos.
When we do well for patients, when we come up with an innovation for an unmet need, when we can improve a patient's life by one of our treatments, our shareholders benefit.
Today, Merck and other big pharma companies look more like Allergan. Their own research teams haven't been so productive lately, so they increasingly buy up drugs and their makers. The old established companies are spending billions buying back their own shares. Roy Vagelos is 86 now. After he retired from Merck, he made a fortune as chairman of the biotech firm Regeneron. But asked what he thinks about newer firms that put Wall Street before patients.
Well, I don't think much of them, of course. The biopharmaceutical business is different from selling buttons and bicycles.
Wall Street, though, might not agree. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
How is owning shares like a box of chocolates? We've got the answer. Shareholder value for movie buffs. Come on, that was a pretty good Forrest Gump. New videos at priceofprofits.org. Coming up.
I came home. I went to my parents and I'm like, I want to be a chef. I want to open restaurants. And they thought I was nuts, you know.
Yeah, parents, you know. He did it anyway. It worked out all right. But first, let's do the numbers. Late day sell-off today. The Dow Industrial is off 34 points, about 0.2%, 17,640. The NASDAQ down 0.8%, 4834. The S&P 500 down 0.3%, 2,071. Home Depot filed an antitrust lawsuit against Visa and MasterCard, claiming the card companies charge too much for their services and that new chip card technology isn't effective. Amen, brother, on that chip card stuff. Home Depot up 1%, Visa down about 0.5%, MasterCard declined 0.8% today. IBM today unveiled Deep Thunder. That's its first joint project with the Weather Channel. IBM shares off 0.25%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note, listen to this. I'm telling you, pay attention. Down to 1.57%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There are a whole bunch of ways that a company can boost shareholder value, to continue with our series here for a bit. It can invest in new products. It can buy another company and its products. It can raise prices. It can cut expenses. Also, and increasingly, companies can buy back their own shares. In the 6 years right after the financial crisis, American companies bought almost $3 trillion worth of their own shares back off the market. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains how those buybacks work and who benefits.
It's 2007, and William McCombs' company suddenly finds itself with $100 million.
We had sold some assets, and we had an inflow of cash.
McComb was CEO of Liz Claiborne, Inc. at the time. It's now called Kate Spade. And he and his board had to figure out what to do with this money.
We had a number of options.
They could have bought more companies, but they wanted to get away from that. Research and development is a thought, but...
We were an apparel company. We don't have research and development.
They could have done nothing, of course.
Hold the cash, sit on it.
But in the end, they spent the money on buying themselves.
The decision that we made as a board was to actually return some cash to shareholders via a share buyback.
The company bought its own stock, took those shares right off the market. S&P 500 companies spent $570 billion doing just this last year alone. The question is, why would a company do that?
ostensibly it benefits shareholders.
Stephen Davidoff Solomon is a professor at UC Berkeley School of Law. Buying up shares, he says, plays with a stock's supply and demand.
With less shares, the idea is that the price will go up.
Buybacks make the remaining shares more valuable, and they make a company's books look better. The company's earnings per share go up if there are fewer shares.
It's a financial trick.
Incidentally, a lot of executives are paid in stock options and get bonuses tied to stock prices. So if they drive up the price of stock, they take home more pay, especially when they sell the stock. And that brings up a really important feature of stock buybacks.
You get dividends for holding the stock. The only way you make money from stock buybacks is selling the stock.
William Lozonik is a professor of economics at UMass Lowell. He says the fact that you have to sell the shares to make the money attracts investors who are only interested in a company for the short term.
Hedge fund activists or shareholder activists.
So-called activist investors, he says, will look for companies with lots of cash. They'll buy stock in these companies and then raise hell until the company buys back shares. Then the stock price goes up and the investors cash out.
Shareholder activists love stock buybacks because it's a great way of taking money out of companies.
2015 saw an all-time high for the number of activist campaigns pressuring companies to return cash to shareholders. It's money, Lozonik says, that could be used for other things, like investing in the company and its employees.
Higher wages, more stable employment, better benefits, that's where middle class comes from.
McComb, the CEO, he actually agrees that companies buying back their own stock can benefit and attract short-term investors.
More times than not in the last 10 years, it's been in response to short-term activists that have been jumping in and wanting to stimulate and create value and get out.
But he says the prevailing philosophy, including the one that drove his own buyback, is that if your company has extra cash, you should give it to shareholders and do it in the most effective way you can. It's a fundamental difference in worldview compared with people like Bill Lozonik.
It really is an idiotic ideology that you run the company for the people who matter least, the people who can get in and out of the company quickest and for whom that is often their only goal.
But ideology aside, shareholders vote. And if an executive doesn't give big investment funds what they want, that executive can be gone. McComb says it's not inherently bad to give money to shareholders through a stock buyback, but he's actually not a big fan of how they're playing out these days. And as for his $100 million buyback back in 2007, he kind of regrets it.
The world changed dramatically in late 2008, as we now know. And it would have been much better for us and frankly our shareholders had we not returned the money via a share repurchase.
Over the 2 years following his buyback, the S&P 500 fell 50%. Now, stock market collapses aren't typical, but markets do go up and down. And coincidentally, companies spend the most on buybacks when the market is high and companies are flush. It's the same issue facing anyone lucky enough to have extra cash. Watch what you do with it, because you never know when you're going to need it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
I had tuna poke for breakfast the other day. It's not my usual fare by any means, but then again, I'm not usually at a fancy Beverly Hills hotel for breakfast either. We went out to the Montage Hotel and its new restaurant, Georgie it's called, run by Jeffrey Zakarian, who you might know from Chopped on the Food Network, where he's a judge, or The Next Iron Chef, also on the Food Channel, of which he won season 4. But as I discovered when we went back into the kitchen, Zakarian knows his way around a recipe, too.
So you're clearly not one for measuring. You're kind of eyeballing this.
Well, thing. I've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
So I know how to do it. But what you do is you underseason, and then you taste.
Right. Zakarian's got two restaurants in New York, the Lamb's Club and the National. He's been a chef for 30-plus years, also a restaurateur, obviously. But he is newish to the L.A. food scene.
I got to say, I should do this for a living.
Home run.
And I made extra for you to try.
I
Isn't that
appreciate
nice of me?
That.
Here you go, tuna poke.
I like that. Got a fork?
Now right. Try that first and make sure you get a little of the puree underneath here.
All right. All right, here we go. That's really good. It's one of those things you put in there is like a little gritty. I guess it's this stuff.
It's the salt.
Yeah.
Big salt. So
yeah.
That salt is there just to give a crunch, a little
yep.
texture.
Yep. Oh, and you can
see how balanced it is? There's not a lot of oil, not a lot of vinegar. It's just the right balance. And what you're doing is you're going back for another one.
Totally. That's the sign of a good dish.
When you go back for the second bite,
totally.
You're like, wow, this is good. And it just, it's like your brain tells you to go back.
You're good if I finish this, right?
You can have the whole thing.
All right.
I'm loving this, actually.
Once I'm done eating, we're actually going to get to work here. That's really good.
Look at this. See? This guy loves this stuff.
I mean, come on. Sorry. I do want to know, though, how a kid from Massachusetts with a degree in... I know.
It's even worse.
With a degree in economics and urban studies winds up doing this.
This business found me. I came from a Middle Eastern family, and whether you know it or not, if you're Middle Eastern, Italian, Jewish, especially Italian...
Food.
It's food. It's food in the morning. What are we eating for lunch? When the mom, breakfast is done, she starts cooking for lunch. The conversation is about the next meal. And that gets in you. So when you go out into the world, and you know, go to school and college and all that stuff, I found myself in France for a sabbatical for a year, right. And I didn't discover it, it was there. What had been there for 3,000 years, two-hour lunches, food, culture, the same thing I was growing up. Yeah. It was just actually happening.
So you bring this back to the States where we're all workaholics and we're on our phones all the time.
I'm still a workaholic.
The idea of taking 2 hours for lunch around here is heresy practice. How do you make that work?
It's not that. It's just the culture,
yeah.
How they live life, the zeitgeist. And I came home. I went to my parents, and I'm like, I want to be a chef. I want to open restaurants. And they thought I was nuts, you know.
Do you know when you see a restaurant that it's going to work?
Uh-uh. I can guess pretty accurately, but there's so many variables. Something's going to be great and get a great review. There are many restaurants in New York City that have 3 stars and close.
Yeah.
I know, I had one. and it was in the middle of a financial crisis. So if you're not funded properly or, you know, you're in bad location, the foodies might like you, the critics might like you, but the people might just not want to go to there enough to support it. It's very expensive to open a restaurant. It's even more expensive to maintain it. And it's just gotten so way more in the last 5 years. It's almost, what the regulations have done to us are just like killing our any margin we have. So people don't want to invest if they can't make margins. So what's going to happen is you're going to have less jobs in the industry. It's a real big problem that everybody is a wisp. No one wants to talk about it, but that's actually what's happening.
Talk about it a little bit, right?
Well,
because margins are already thin in this business,
margins,
right?
Margins are nothing. They're nothing. They're 5% maybe, 6%.
So
if you get to 10, you're a genius.
So why are you doing this, man?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think it's partly because we love what we do. We're very passionate about it. And we're always trying to find ways to get better and work through it. Anything, but you know, we're the biggest job creators in New York. In New York, is the restaurant industry.
Right.
We're it. There's 600,000 jobs.
What's it like opening a restaurant and running a restaurant here versus New York City?
We run the restaurant for the customer either way.
Mm-hmm.
So to be successful, the customer has to really feel like in 5 seconds when they walk in the door, they get it. It's called the 5 second rule.
I was just going to say, really 5 seconds?
Yes. You walk in, lighting right, music light. I look good. This place, it feels right. And that's all like very subjective.
Yeah.
But if they get that, you got a real good chance of getting them back again because that's half the battle. And then you present them with the food and drink. But it's a staging. This is Hollywood. It's 3 shows a day. It's Broadway. Here, it's a little bit more casual. But basically, it's showtime on both coasts.
There's a great quote I read about you just in terms of how closely you keep an eye on things. If I see a radish in the garbage can in one of my kitchens, you're out of here. Food waste is a big thing for
you? Food waste is terrible. When I see, you know, we waste so much food in this culture. It's terrible. We waste it by giving too much to the customer. They don't finish it. And, you know,
we're Americans, man. We want the big portions.
That's misinformation. It's also misinformation nutritionally. You don't have to have all these calories. And then when we give it to them, some take it home, but most don't. They throw it away. And that's just, it kills me. It's a big deal for me. So we'll try to use everything we have many ways, so that we don't have waste. And so we size the portions correctly and we price correctly. If you want more of something, we'll give you another portion. You know, it's like, it's okay. But just, we don't want half the portion come back and then we throw it away.
Talk to me for a second about the culture of the celebrity chef in this country.
What does that mean? That's an open-ended question.
Yeah, I want you to talk
culture
to me. I want you to talk to me for a minute about the culture of celebrity chef. I mean, you know, you've done it. You're
in
a little bit.
There's a lot of really good celebrity chefs who are actually really good chefs. And then there are a lot of celebrities on TV in the food world who aren't chefs. And they will tell you they're not chefs, but they're very entertaining. I got my first job on TV when I was in 2007. 30 years before that, I've been a chef, cooking and, you know, opening restaurants. So I was a chef and a restaurateur first. And then I got lucky, and someone said, you want to go to this show called Chopped? And I'm like, what? What's this? Chopped? That sounds silly. I mean, it was never going to work. It's never going to work. And my agent, Scott Feldman, said, you know, try it. I think you'd be great on it. So I went on it, and it was, you know, got paid nothing. And it was a pilot. And it's now the most popular show on Food Network. And it's been 8 years I've been on this thing. And it's just one show led to another. And that's how it is in the Food Network. Fortunately for me, they use the talent that they've had. Right. So if you're reliable and they like you and the public likes you, they use you for other shows. So when I won Iron Chef, people said, I never knew you could cook. So perception's reality, right? They thought I was only a judge.
Right.
But perception's everything, right? And so now they know I can cook, but it's very strange. I had 30 years of experience. That's all I've been doing is cooking.
Jeffrey, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate it.
I got to say, that tuna poke was delicious. I did commit the unforgivable sin, though, of not saving some for my producers and engineer, so I got in trouble for that. I took some pictures while we were out there. You can see them at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a bit more food, although not quite like my tuna poke. Outback Steakhouse is offering an upgrade to its Bloomin' Onion appetizer, which is a deep-fried agglomeration of oniony goodness. Now I bring you the fully loaded Bloomin' Onion, which is going to be topped with Aussie cheese fries, bacon, and spicy ranch dressing. It can be yours at a cost of just 2,360 calories, way off the U.S. recommended daily allowances chart. Obviously, I mean, I'm sure it's delicious, but what? Oh, we're a little squeezed today. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lanch, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.